you know, one of the first kids I ever coached, and he was, you know, a great kid, and he was a high school varsity player. That was my first coaching job when I was about 25 years old, and I thought I knew everything. And I was not the greatest coach for a lot of kids, but I was really passionate. I was really driven. I was super, super competitive. I was still playing. I loved to jump in practice, and God forbid my team lost the small-sided game, everyone would run. And so it was a couple years after that, and I was coaching college soccer at University of Vermont, and this kid Pat calls me, and he calls me up. And he was done with college at that point. He was applying to med school at UVM, and he just said, "Hey, I'm coming to town. I want to get together with you." But he said, "You know, coach, I just want to say thank you, because every time, you know, I'm studying for the MCATs and I want to put my books down, or every time I, you know, want to just leave the weight room early or whatever," he goes, "I hear your voice saying, 'Hey, is that your best? Can't you do a little more? Can't you do one more set?'" And he goes, "And so I do one more." And he goes, "And I just want to thank you for that." And I was kind of stunned by this, because again, this was years before, and I had never considered the fact that, you know, my words would last. And, you know, I hung up the phone and I turned to the coach I was working with, and I told him that story, and he's like, "Man, that's great." I'm like, "That's not great. Like, that's the worst thing I've ever heard." I'm like, "He remembers what I said?" And I'm like, "Because for every kid like Pat, like, there's plenty of kids that I told to, like, go take up kayaking or something else, you know?" I wasn't the greatest coach for, you know, I was a good coach for Pat, I think, but not for everyone else. And so this was just kind of this first aha moment for me of, like, again, every moment matters. Something that we say or do in public, emotional, we're keeping score, it's a game, in the heat of the moment, something that comes out of our mouth can stick with a kid the rest of their life. And we better be really, really intentional about those things that we say and that we do. And certainly I was not perfect, am not perfect, screw up often, but I think this was really this huge moment for me to be like, wow, like we really have a lot of influence here.
Every coach has those players we get through to. We connect, we make an impact on their life. But what about the ones we don't connect with? You just heard from John O'Sullivan. He's a former podcast guest. He's also the head of Changing the Game and the author of Every Moment Matters. Now, John's going to be on the podcast with us this week and next week, sharing with us some of my favorite parts of his latest book, which is awesome, by the way. More on that later. Now, in today's episode, John's going to give us the first step in the process of becoming a transformational coach. It's a step that we need to continuously repeat. If you skip this step, you will continue to miss out on life-changing relationships with your players. But if you follow this step, you're going to not only change more lives, but you will start to experience a new joy in coaching that you've been missing. Welcome to the Coaching Culture Podcast. I'm JP Nurbin alongside my co-host Nate Sanderson. And every week in 30 minutes or less, we're giving you transformational leadership tools and strategies. This podcast is brought to you by Thrive On Challenge, which provides mentorship for coaches to help them grow as a coach and build their culture. You can learn more at thriveonchallenge.com. You're listening to episode 117, Why and How You Coach Matter in Every Moment, with our guest, John O'Sullivan. Now, just before we get into today's episode, I got a special deal I want to let you know about, where if you buy John's new book, Every Moment Matters, before Christmas, and you email me the receipt, I'll send you back one of the following three systems that I know coaches love to get their hands on, because they help you to take your values as a coach and build them into your team through a systematic approach. The first one is the competitive cauldron. The second one is the talent assessment system. The third one is the coaching journal system. Now, if you buy Every Moment What Matters, you send me the receipt, I'll send you one of those. If you buy John's book and my book, Calling Up, you buy both of them together, you send me the receipts to those books, I'll send you all three systems, which are really exclusive to the coaches that we work with in our mentorship program. So this week in the podcast, we're going to be diving into this idea of, what does it feel like to play for you, to be a part of your team? And we're going to be doing that with a former guest of the podcast, John O'Sullivan from Changing the Game. He's got a new book coming out in the next couple of weeks called Every Moment Matters. And I can tell every listener here with 100% confidence, this is one of the best books out there on transformational coaching, I think, for coaches to pick up. And one of the things that I think that coaches struggle on this idea of transformational coaching is that there's so much transactional or old school coaching going out there, but also there's so much information. There's almost information overload and there's misinformation. And John does an exceptional job of, I think, really putting this together in a 4-part book that makes it very, very clear, not just the principles behind transformational coaching, but the strategies that I think are going to be effective at every level, the youth level up to the collegiate and professional level. Now, John, one of the things I loved, just even from the introduction of your book, was the personal story you told of when a former player called you to tell you just a little bit about the impact that you had on his life. And I really connected with that story because I think I had had similar experiences where a former player called me to tell me a little bit about, or I connected with them and just thanked me for the impact I had on their life. But eventually I made this realization, like you did, I think, which is there's a lot of people I'm still not getting through to. There's a lot of players I'm still not connecting with. So I really, really appreciated that story.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks. And first of all, you know, thank you to you guys for having me back on and helping me share the message of Every Moment Matters and everything, because I really, you know, this has been a lot of years of work of interviewing and research that kind of came together in this book, and being out there on the front lines with coaches who, just like you talk about, JP, like, you know what, they want to coach this way, and they need sort of permission to coach this way in this world where sometimes it's not allowed, right? Or the only focus is, did you win? And I start the book with the story of, you know, one of the first kids I ever coached. And this was just kind of this first aha moment for me of, like, again, every moment matters. Something that we say or do in public, emotional, we're keeping score, it's a game. In the heat of the moment, something that comes out of our mouth can stick with the kid the rest of their life. And we better be really, really intentional about those things that we say and that we do. And certainly I was not perfect, am not perfect, screw up often, but I think this was really this huge moment for me to be like, wow, like we really have a lot of influence here. And so that's why I started the book with that story, because it's really personal and sort of set me on this course of becoming a different type of coach.
Well, one of the things I really appreciated also about that story is I know that many coaches and I myself, we use those players that tell us, hey, you made an impact, to justify our coaching and also just our lack of growth and improvement. I think sometimes we go, well, I've made an impact on these kids. The other kids, they just weren't probably coachable. That's on them.
Yeah. And it's very easy to blame the learner when they don't learn. And I think if you had me list sort of some of the biggest changes in John O'Sullivan, the 48-year-old coach today, and John O'Sullivan, the 25-year-old coach when I first got started, was it's that now I look first at myself. I look at the session I ran. I look at my communication skills. And if a kid's not getting it, I first look at myself and the environment I'm creating. And then, you know, then if I go, no, you know what, I think I'm doing the right things here, this kid's just not getting it, or this kid's just not into it. You know, maybe they don't even want to be here. Their mom or dad forced them to be here. But I think by looking at ourselves first, that's really what great leaders do, is what more can I do for this athlete? And then if I say, man, you know what, I've ticked all the boxes and he or she is still not bought in, then I kind of shift stance to go, okay, well, you better buy in. It's not me who has to change. It's you who has to change. And, I just think that's an important realization as a coach. As a young coach, I was just like, okay, you know, clearly if you don't get it, it couldn't possibly be my fault because I'm a teacher. I taught it, so you must have learned it, right? And that's not necessarily the case.
In part one of your book, it's titled Why Do I Coach? But, you know, and you talked about first focusing on reflecting inward and kind of being more self-aware in our coaching. One of the big things I took in part one was that we need to reflect as coaches what type of environment or culture we create, and more of how it feels. Like, what does it feel like when players walk in the building? You share a really cool story about Steve Kerr and Pete Carroll and how kind of Pete Carroll mentored Steve Kerr. And one of the things that really stuck out about to me about that story, and I know he was on Kerr was on your podcast, The Way of Champions, but Steve Kerr was just as concerned eventually with not just the experience for Steph Curry, but also what it felt like for the 15th man on his team, the guy that was just battling to stay on an NBA roster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's such a great story and a great reminder that, you know, we serve everybody, not just our leading scorer, not just our starting players, but we have to make everyone on that roster feel invaluable, right? Without necessarily being the most valuable. And, you know, so Steve, you know, told a story about, you know, even though he won 5 NBA titles as a player and now 3 as a coach, you know, he said, you know, most of my career, I was a reserve. I was coming off the bench. And so I'm very cognizant of what it feels like to be on that bench, you know. And he said, you know, so he goes, my job as a coach is to look at each person and coach the person, not the sport, not just the basketball player. He said, so Steph Curry, the biggest thing for him is everyone wants Steph's time. He has so many demands on his time. He's getting dragged here, there, everywhere. My job for him is to create this space where he can just be a basketball player. He can come here and love the game and love his teammates and enjoy himself and get better and tune out every other distraction in his life and every other demand on his time. But the last guy on my bench, his biggest concern is this my last contract? Am I going to be out of the league next year? If I'm out of the league, what am I going to do, right? This has been my life, and now I'm 25 years old, and basketball, pro basketball, is not my career anymore. What am I going to do? He said, so I have to serve him for what he needs. His problems are not Steph's problems. His biggest distractions, the things that interfere with his performance, they're not that. And he goes, you know, now one thing he learned from Phil Jackson was, you know, Phil was really good at just anytime, anywhere, he might look to the 12th guy on the bench and be like, boom, you're in, right? So you always had to be tuned in and focused on the bench because he could throw you in any game, any scenario, you better be ready. He's like, you know, that's part of it. He goes, but you can't, that's not the whole thing, right? You really got to know who they are as people and what their biggest fears are, what they want, what they need, and do your best to serve them within that team environment. I think it's just great advice, and it's awesome to me that a coach like Steve Kerr, who is obviously a phenomenal player, also comes at it from this perspective of not just the Michael Jordan perspective, but, you know, the guy coming off the bench as well.
I think one of the other cool parts about that kind of intro into the book is along the same lines of Kerr's interactions with Carroll was when Steve Kerr goes up and he gets to spend a couple days with the Seahawks. And Carroll kind of challenges him to figure out not even necessarily what the standards are and the values are that he wants for the program at Golden State, but who is Steve Kerr as an individual, right? Trying to find that authentic place of what are your most true values for you as a person. And I think so often that is overlooked by coaches. You know, we think about when we think of our own identity, we get wrapped up in we're going to play a certain style, we're going to coach in a certain way, we're going to have a certain persona on the sidelines. But the reality is if we can't drill into some of those core values for us individually before we start unpacking those other things with our team, it's really difficult to be authentic. And I love the point in your book where you talk about players will see right through that when you're trying to be somebody else.
You have to be your authentic self. And that was Pete Carroll's advice to Steve Kerr was, you know, the Golden State Warriors, when people come to work, it has to be an authentic reflection of you, Steve, as a human being, right? And so what are the things that drive you the most? And he sent Steve home with sort of this homework. He said, this is the most important stuff, not your offense, not your defense. Think about what matters most to you, you know, and for Pete Carroll, that's like competing. He loves competitiveness. And Steve Kerr is like, you know what? You see it in everything they do. At the, you know, with the Seahawks, everything's competing. And so, you know, Steve, you know, came up with joy and competitiveness and compassion and mindfulness, right? And he's like, these are the four things that matter to me most. And it has to be joyful because we play basketball, and it has to be competitiveness because that's going to make us better. But there's got to be a lot of love, and there's got to be a big bond and compassion here. And then, you know, we got to be mindful. We have to be prepared mentally as well as physically, and we have to be, you know, learn to get ourselves in the right mindset to perform our best. And he said, so this is what, you know, this was the environment that this has to be about. And, you know, Pete Carroll's advice is, you know, Steve, your values can't be my values. They can't be John Wooden's values. They can't be Greg Popovich's values. It's got to be you, because if you're trying to be someone that you truly are not, your players will see right through this. And this isn't just with NBA pros. I mean, Nate, you know, this is with high school kids, right? This is with youth kids, right? I coach 12-year-old boys right now. You know, my things for me is 100%, you know, it's joy, it's passion, and it's competitiveness. Like, that's what I try to bring to every practice session, and the kids feel it and see it. And, you know, that's the most important thing. And if I tried to be someone that I'm not, you know, it just, that they would see that, right? Because I couldn't bring the same energy and dedication to that thing. And so, I just love that advice. And it's why I started the book with this whole idea of like, why do I coach? Because, if you get that part wrong, everything else that follows doesn't really matter, right? So doing that self-examination and understanding yourself, that's where it has to start. And when you figure out what you're all about, and then you create that environment that reflects those things. Now, you know, if you're all about, you know, cruelty, please don't coach, right? But like, you know, these things that we talk about, you know, if respect is something that really matters to you, you have to model it, and you have to talk about it every day, right? If competitiveness really matters to you, you have to model it. You have to talk about it every day. If being prepared, you know, on and on and on. So I think really by coaches going through this same sort of self-examination, that is the foundation of your program. That's the foundation of your team. Then you lay on the defense and the offense and the techniques and the tactics and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I think one of the important things there is, it doesn't happen with your team overnight. I think understanding what our vision, our values, and it takes a lifetime of experiences, and you're always constantly reshaping those. Now, what I think is really cool about the first part of your book is you get this purpose, this vision, the values kind of cemented, but then you really start to move into what's really important is that how we coach is actually in line with that purpose. And you move into part two to how do I coach? And one thing that really stuck out at me, to me about part two, was that you really dive into some of the research, the science on teaching strategies and making sure that you are teaching in a way that is backed up by research. There's a really great quote there that I'm going to pull out from part two. And it is, a study by the U.S. Department of Education laid out the actual learning strategies that could be backed by science. And that extremely short list contained spacing, interleaving, and testing. In other words, the most effective learning strategies, as backed by actual evidence, demonstrate that long-term learning is often the least obvious in the short term. But I really wanted you to kind of have it just take a few minutes to kind of discuss these strategies around spacing, interleaving, and testing, because from us as coaches, the old school method of any practice is repetition, repetition, repetition. We need lots of repetition, and that's just going to transfer into the game. Can you kind of talk a little bit more about those three strategies?
Yeah, sure. So this is really important, right? Because you can jump on the internet every day. You know, you Google learning strategies and you'll find, you know, 52 different ads, right? Learn Spanish in 2 days and, you know, all this sort of stuff, right? Everything's a shortcut. Everything's a hack. But yeah, so this was really interesting, was that, you know, the U.S. Department of Education said, well, let's actually, you know, look at everything out there and say what actually has peer-reviewed empirical evidence that shows this works. And there's just these couple of strategies, right? So interleaving means, you know, is means sometimes it's, we call it like random practice or whatever, versus what we would call master block practice. Mast practice would be I hit 57 irons in the row on the range, or you know, I shoot 50 free throws in a row. But what happens in mast practice is every time we repeat the same thing over and over, our brain kind of shuts down a little bit, right? It requires less work to you know, perform that physical task, and it's just not sticky learning. Now, here's the thing. When you mass your practice in the short term, at the end of that day, it actually looks like you're better at shooting free throws or hitting your seven iron. But when you go to retrieve that later on, right, in your competition, it's not sticky learning. So there's this great book called Make It Stick. The author, Peter Brown, he says, you know, repetition is one of the most often things cited by coaches and teachers and stuff. And it's completely wrong, right? You want repetition without repetition, which means you get lots of shots or you hit lots of clubs, but you do it in a more representative environment, right? So it has decisions, it has directions, it has defenders, it has all these different things that we want in our sporting games, versus just repeating the same thing over and over and over, right? So like there's one really interesting story that they did a study on golfers, pro golfers, right? And they put them on a range and hit 10 seven irons in a row. And they put on one of those suits that they use to make these like cartoon, like avatar type movies, right? Where they move and it measures every movement of your body. And in those 10 seven irons, the professional golfer really makes the same exact swing when he's standing on the range and hitting to the same spot, same swing every time. Now you put him on the course and you throw him a bunch of seven irons. Here's one in the rough. Here's one from the right side. Here's one from the left side with this pin position, downhill, uphill, whatever. And he makes 10 different swings, right? So if all you're doing is standing on the range, hitting seven irons, you're not actually preparing for the golf match, right? And so I think this is one of the most important things that we can do as coaches is we create lots of reps of the things that we want to see happen, but we do it without endless repetition. Right, because that is there is shown that it's much more sticky learning, and people will be able to retrieve it later. And so, I think this is one of the most important things that we can do as coaches, right there, spacing, which is, can we space something out so just as the players are about to forget it, we touch on it again, and it forces them to retrieve it, right? So, if I'm teaching young soccer players something new, I'm not going to space it out as much as I might teach more experienced players something where, hey, we did this a month ago, let's see if they can pull it back up again, because they've seen this before. Whereas I might have to do that, you know, with something new with brand new players, I might have to do it 2 days later. And then that's, you know, testing or quizzing. If we stop looking at quizzing as like a way to, you know, measure achievement and start looking at it as retrieval practice, right? Forcing our brain to go back into the depths and remember what we learned. That's what makes learning more robust. And so when we, you know, obviously the game is like a quiz, right? So that's one way to test if they've learned it. But the other way is just, you know, set up activities in your practice where, let's say, you know, let's say you guys are basketball coaches, right? You've worked on your transition fast break or whatever, and you've talked about patterns or talked about things that you're going to do, right? 2 weeks later, set up the same drill. Don't cue them up with all the answers of, hey, remember when we worked on this? What did we talk about doing? Right? Don't cue them up with anything. Set up the drill, say nothing, roll the ball out, and let's see if they do it. Right. And if they repeat the things that we've worked on, they've learned it. And if they go back to what they were doing before, guess what? They haven't. And so these are really, really powerful strategies that when we're mindful as coaches of, well, what's my practice design like, we're going to get better learning. And it doesn't always look pretty on the day. It's actually kind of ugly. Parents don't like it as much because there's not straight lines and cones and all this beautiful pattern and all this great success. But when we do it this way, they're far more likely over time to be able to do it when there's pressure on, right? And I think these are just, if I'm a coach, I should know this stuff.
Yeah. And you mentioned Alan Keene in the book, and he was on our podcast, episode 99, talking about that exact thing. And I think coaches hear that and they think that's crazy, you know, starting practice with a game, with a scrimmage, you know, but, you know, it's supported by evidence, right? So I think that's the big thing too, that I really enjoyed about part two was, and really the whole book in general, because you keep coming back to things that are grounded by science, you know, and there's so much research out there about, not just on how skills are developed, you know, skill acquisition, but even just around communication and understanding emotional intelligence and what we know about the brain. And you have a lot of great stuff in there that is backed up by science, which I think so often coaches are still resistant to. I'm sure you travel, you speak all over the world, and you're still seeing kickback even when you present the information, right?
Yeah. And again, the challenge with a lot of this stuff that's actually proven to enhance learning is that because in the short term, I don't feel as good about it, right? I've struggled today, right? I didn't hit, you know, very well in batting practice because they threw me random pitches in random spots. But over time, that's going to make me a better hitter. And so sometimes our job as a coach is convincing the parents and convincing the kids that they're actually learning when they feel like they're not. Because when you survey them after a massed practice, right? If Nate took his whole basketball practice and just shot free throws at the end of that practice, and if you ask the kids, are you better at free throw shooting? Most of them would say, yeah, I am, because I just shot 200 free throws, right? But if he intersperses it in with sprints and pressure and things like that, like, you know, with like, you take like a, I look at a free throw as like a penalty kick in soccer, right? You know, I end a lot of my practices with just like a little shootout, especially if the game's tied, and the kids love it, right? And I used to, you know, like try to make it like, okay, get out of the way, don't say anything, right? But now I'm like, yeah, you know what? The other team, harass the guy shooting, you know, yell at him, make fun of him, you know, whatever, because that's far more, you know, representative of the heart rate and the environment he's going to kick a penalty kick in a game than like standing there and making it this, you know, totally, you know, sanitary environment where there's no distractions, right? Same thing with, you know, Nate, I know you're really big on this with, you know, you have the research on how your teams have, you know, shot better in the postseason, right? Ramp up the pressure and we perform better because we practice in a way that's really representative.
Now, I was going to say, John, that I really also think you've hit on a big piece there of you're not seeing the immediate effects, like you said, and that's why coaches shy away from it. I think when it comes to alternative ways of communication and motivating our team, and you may agree or disagree with this, but when it comes to not yelling at your players, well, yelling or other extrinsic motivators like that, they're effective. They're often very effective in the short term. And so coaches are really, really afraid that if they move to try different things that are really trying to tap into some intrinsic motivation within their players, that they're not going to, they don't see those effects right away. And that can be pretty scary.
Yeah. And it's all, again, it all goes down to creating this environment that things like, you know, competitiveness and accountability, those are non-negotiables, right? I don't have to yell at my team about competing hard because they've agreed that this is something they're going to hold each other accountable for and they're going to bring every day. Now, I'm not saying that there's no days when they don't show up and they're kind of out of it, right? And they're tired and they're not having their best day. But more often than not, that's not like me yelling at them. That's a moment where I'm like, guys, come in. All right. How's it going right now? Right? How are we playing? How are we doing? Is this what we're like as a team? No, coach. You think you can fix that, right? And I do this with 11-year-olds. So when people are like, oh, I can't do that with my 18-year-olds, that's bull, right?
Now that's it for our part one of our conversation with John. We'll dive into the second half of his book next week. In the meantime, I cannot encourage you enough to get his book just in time for Christmas. It's really honestly the most complete and comprehensive book on transformational coaching to date, in my opinion. If a coach is to apply the principles and strategies from the book, they will develop more skilled and intelligent athletes. More importantly, they would improve their player engagement, their players' enjoyment, their relationships, and the character of everyone in their program, including themselves. All right, I think every coach in the world needs to read this book. It's why I'm giving away one of my most popular and effective systems for coaches that actually help you to actualize your values within you, within you yourself, and within your program. All you need to do is buy John's book, Every Moment Matters, and you can get either the competitive college or the talent assessment system or the coaching journal system. If you buy Every Moment Matters and my book, Calling Up, I'll send all three to you. Be sure to email me the receipts at jpnurbin@thriveonchallenge.com.